this week's Yes to Life show. I'm Robin Daly, regular host for the show, and I'm the founder of the UK registered charity Yes to Life, which for more than a decade has been helping people with cancer to access the benefits of integrative medicine. My guest on the show today is author and freelance health writer Jerome Byrne. Jerome is a regular contributor to the national newspapers and runs a blog site called Health Insight UK. He's particularly interested in the debate between drug and non-drug approaches and regularly writes on topics of interest to those with cancer. Today, we're having a bit of a news roundup covering some of the cancer-related news from recent weeks and looking behind the tabloid headlines at the real issues at stake. I'm talking to Jerome in Islington. Hi, Jerome. Great to have you on the show again. Your last appearance was my very first show, I believe. So today, I want to talk to you about some of the items that are relevant to our shared field of interest that have appeared in the news in the recent months. I know you're very much up on the latest developments and will have written about many of them yourself. The first thing I want to start out looking at is the Cancer Drugs Fund. It's just been through a metamorphosis. I know you've got some pretty strong opinions about its history so far. Can you start out by giving us a potted history?
Yes. As a medical health journalist, I follow the whole issue of evidence and the fact that in order to make any claims, the official line is you have to have evidence, and we think having evidence is a really good idea, but the way that it's got, particularly in cancer, is not quite as good as the official line says that it is. And an astounding, really, example of this is what's happened with the Cancer Drugs Fund, which was set up in 2010, I think it was. Yes, 2010. And the idea behind it was to give access to people who weren't able to get drugs because NICE had said that they were either too expensive or not effective enough. And so it was decided, can't say exactly why, but it would seem to be an element of publicity that we're here to help people, we're here to get life-saving treatments to patients which is being denied to them. It was a rather odd idea because they'd been denied by a body whose job it was to evaluate them and say, are they worthwhile? So you might think that they were, it would be unlikely that overall they'd show a lot of benefit. But over the fund was wound up last year, so that it had been running for 6 years.
As long as that, right.
During that time, astoundingly, it had spent £1.2 billion. So lack of funding, NHS in crisis, how good a value have we got for this massive spend? Mm. Mm. And the short answer is absolutely nothing. Wow. The review was done by a couple of top oncologists working at London hospitals, and they looked at what the drugs they were using, how good the evidence for them was, and also what the results were. So that in this model where you're supposed to be having only evidence-based medicine, proper clinical trials showing benefit, of the drugs that were approved in just 1 year, that was in 2015, the last year that it was running, 60% of the drugs that were given to patients had not been put through proper clinical trials and didn't have statistically significant benefit showing anywhere. The overall survival benefit, looking up across the whole period, was a benefit of 3.2 months, which is about the benefit which is consistently comes up for drugs overall. The one class of drug which recently has been doing rather better are the immune therapy ones. A proportion of patients get rather better than that. Some of them can get up to 9 or even 18 months, something like that. It's about 25-30%, I think, but that's really the only area where the benefit, overall benefit, is more than about 3 or 4 months. Of course, some get a lot less, some a lot more, but that's the average.
Right.
But the reviewers then went on to say, well, that's the average benefit, but what was the overall kind of clinical benefit when you factor in side effects and toxic damage and the rest of it?
Yeah,
and
like.
When they did all that, there's now criteria developed by oncologists to measure value to patients. And on that basis, the report concluded that the drugs fail to show any evidence of meaningful clinical benefit. So over £1 billion on cancer drugs for no meaningful clinical benefit.
Wow. That's completely, that's not something I've heard of before. They've actually got this measure of overall benefit to the patient. That's quite a new idea, actually, looking at from the patient's point of view, like, oh yes, we succeeded in keeping them alive for six months, but it was the living hell. That's important, isn't it? That's a move in the right direction.
I don't have any more details about how it was done. Probably the full account of it may well give details of that if people are interested. Mm. But the fact that those two are factored together. And of course, that then, as we'll be talking about later, leads into the benefits of a non-drug approach where you don't have those damaging effects and then there's issues around evidence, which we'll also be coming in and looking at. So again, the professors working on it were quite critical that they had this ring-fenced area, which presumably was run by senior professors and oncologists, and they were using drugs which were known not to have done terribly well. They used these huge sums of money, and the results of the report was really not widely covered. A couple of papers ran it and then it just disappeared, and there was nowhere that I saw that there was any demand that there should be some kind of investigations, head's role,
accountability.
You know, who has been actually responsible for wasting this vast sum of money. And the other element, which again relates to the business of evidence, is that one of the conditions of setting it up was that they would gather data on what actually happened to trials in the real world. They were supposed to be having information on the when treatment stopped, how many people survived more than 30 days, what the side effects were and so on, so that you'd get a sort of real-time look at what effect these drugs were actually having. And at the end, when they came to analyse it, 93% of the outcome data was incomplete. So the one thing they were supposed to do that to be useful,
sort of payback,
they didn't do either. So it does look like a feeding frenzy for the drug companies, and us taxpayers and all patients kind of pick up the tab. So that's one example of absolutely non-evidence-based medicine in the field of cancer, with no comeback at all. So it's interesting to compare that with what's going on with a project with the charity commissioners.
We'll come on to that in a second. Can you just tell us about the fund itself? Because it hasn't gone away, it's still there. It's morphed now, and what's the deal now?
Well, astoundingly, given what has been, what the result was, rather than saying we will roll this thing up and never again do anything like that, the new position is that they started one last year. It started running. It claims to address some of the old problems. It would no longer support the provision of drugs that have been appraised but not recommended, which is obviously sensible. However, it's still going to provide funding for new drugs that are awaiting a nice appraisal. Right. So, if you were to be cynical about it, you'd say it was a kind of bonus to the drug companies. They could produce a new drug, they could price it at whatever they wanted to do, it might take nice a year before they actually appraised it, and all the time it could be used and paid for, and then if it turned out not to be worthwhile, they'd say, oh whoops, well actually we've now got a new one and can you please pay for that as well. So it's Again, the idea that this is all evidence-based and so on is clearly not the case.
Yes, I mean, it sounds better than the last one, in as much as least the ones they decided are rubbish are not going to get through.
Yes.
And it is obviously more hopeful that something that they haven't tested yet may
might
help.
Do. Yes.
And for desperate patients, I'm sure that's a lifeline for some. So it's definitely got some pluses. It is an improvement, isn't it?
But there's nothing here to say what will happen if they don't provide the kind of data that they failed to provide
right.
in the past time. Which
well, that's so important now if we've got actually drugs that are not trialled at all.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So on to the Charity Commission. So, yeah, this is another item in the news. There's an investigation currently into CAM therapy providers in the charity sector. So for people who missed this piece of news, would you like to tell us what's happening?
Well, for a long time, as anyone who's interested in cancer will be aware, there has been a running battle, sort of low-level guerrilla warfare, between people who are trying to supply CAM, complementary alternative medicine, which covers anything from acupuncture to vitamin C therapy to diet and so on, to help patients. And the very short description of it would be that it's pretty popular with patients. Nearly every patient, or a large proportion of them, will try something. Some try to do all of it, some just a bit to support chemotherapy and so on. Very popular. And pretty heavily resisted by the cancer establishment. In fact, there are various rules about what you can say and what you can't and so on. It's all quite heavily policed. And there's a group of self-confessed skeptics or people who hunt down pseudoscience and who claim that what needs to happen to these CAM therapies is they need to be subject to the same kind of controls and trials and tests and so on, and standards of evidence that exist in the proper medical scientific area. And there's an old joke which they would use, which was something along the lines, what do you call a complementary medicine that works? Medicine, because if it works, it will be used by proper medical people. So by definition, CAM is things which don't work or rely on the placebo and so on. So there's been a long-running battle to try to running trials on non-drug therapies, and very often, if you talk to people who have tried, who have examined these trials, they'll tell you that they don't really fit the way that they're actually used. Very often, they simply test one intervention, and most people who are using those will use two or three or more. And then there are other factors, which is that, for example, if you're having vitamins and so on, you need to know what the vitamin status of people are before you put them on the vitamins, or what the dose is going to be. And there are a lot of factors like that which very often the official trials, which conclude this stuff doesn't work, hasn't really done it in a useful way.
Right.
So you're dealing with a sort of a rigged deck to begin with. Yesterlife is one of the charities which the skeptics are attempting to undermine, really. They want to have a set of standards whereby the claims that are made for various treatments have been put through this evidence-based system. And what Yes to Life says is that this is really not the appropriate way of testing what's going on, because the standard approach for a randomised controlled trial, A, it's incredibly expensive, and so very few of these kind of approaches have been subject to that, because who's going to pay for it? And secondly, they're usually done on their own, if they're done at all, rather than being part of a project. And the money isn't there for them, and so it's really not appropriate to apply the standards of conventional medicine to the CAM one, which is not a question of special pleading. It's simply a realistic way of saying we need to find a proper way to test these things, and the way that's being proposed at the moment isn't the appropriate one. So the people at Yes to Life have been having to fill in lengthy forms about exactly what they think about it, but the essential message is that rather than trying to find out how effective these treatments are, and the money and the resources and the proper systems aren't really there to assess them in a fair and useful way, a much more sensible approach is to say, how safe are they? Because one of the things that is very clear with standard treatments is that they are toxic, they are dangerous. We've just seen that with the Cancer Drug Fund. So what Yes to Life is suggesting is that rather than trying to put these treatments out of business by failing to come up with evidence for them, it's much better to say, show that they're safe, and then to give patients the right to choose whether they want to follow those treatments, probably with the information that there hasn't been the trials available, but if you want to try it, we have pretty good evidence that it's not going to do you any form of serious harm. And that would be the position that Yes to Life is taking. Whether the charity commissions will be bullied into applying more strict criteria is something that we're still waiting to see.
Well, it's a really important area, because it's sort of questioning the very nature of charities and what they've been doing in the last 50 to 100 years, where they've essentially have been out there filling in gaps in our healthcare system. This is a major feature of charities. They've filled some of these acknowledged gaps in the healthcare, and they've done that because they have a flexibility that isn't there in the NHS. It's evidence-based medicine is a straitjacket that means that, you know, that you're just not going to get these things from your hospital anyway, because they don't fit the criteria of EBM. So if this same straitjacket is applied to the charities, then essentially we'll get uniform medicine, it'll be the same stuff everywhere, and from Yes to Life's point of view, it'd be like stepping back a few decades in terms of patient choice. This is really the most criminal aspect of it, I think, even considering a move like this. And the other side of it, I think, is very important, is that these charities exist. They open, this is what they do, they say so, Yes to Life says what it does, and garner support on the basis of what it says it does. And so it's not hoodwinking anybody, it's actually saying this, you know, CAM we think is a good thing, and people are giving money for that to enable patients to receive it, and the patients who are receiving it are choosing to have it as well. So everybody is exercising their right as a human being and a citizen of the UK here to give and receive CAM therapies. So who on earth is some EBM board to say, no, you can't do that when it's completely safe? It's outrageous, actually.
And in fact, another element there is the fact that the even within the medical establishment, there's a long history of saying we need to include the patients. We need to provide things which the patients want.
Right.
And that this is an important element of care. And I know in various other areas it's recognised that if patients are given a treatment which they want and are interested in and keen on, the results are going to be rather better. So, it makes sense all the way around. And so the only effect of this, the current charity investigation is going to put things which the patients actually want and which they're prepared to take on, and put it out of their reach for no basis, really, other than saying, well, it hasn't been passed some sort of arbitrary abstract standard. And if you look at the results of this arbitrary abstract standard and the way it's applied to conventional treatments, it's really not a very impressive one in terms of benefiting patients.
Yeah, very good point. I think it's interesting to note this almost direct conflict between the ongoing government policy, which has been there, passed from one government to another for decades now of trying to make healthcare more patient-centered and to give patients more choice, and evidence-based medicine, which seeks to tell people what they can have. The two things are almost head-to-head. And if you like, those are the people who are supporting CAM and the people who are trying to stop it are almost squarely in those two camps. One of them is actually trying to promote patient choice, and the other one's trying to take it away. So this is the battle we're having, and I think the government policy doesn't stand much of a chance if EBM rules the day, because where's the choice in that?
And the other point is that evidence-based medicine, by definition, is talking about averages. It says,
right,
this is, if you give this treatment to 100 people or whatever, 20%, 30% will benefit. That's it. They don't actually even need to know who's going to benefit, or whether there are ways you can find, or hidden within the statistics, it may well be that there was a group of people who benefited an awful lot, and it might be to do with their genes, or it might be to do with something else they were doing, all sorts of reasons. So the fact that overall there's a benefit of what it is, and even the benefits then are not that great with the drugs, the people, if you simply follow the evidence-based rules, you're going to miss an awful lot of people who may benefit quite extensively.
Definitely. And the other thing you were mentioning there about this, within conventional medicine, you're always looking at this balance between safety and efficacy all the time, aren't they? Of course, the safety profiles of a lot of these things are not that great. There are a lot of side effects. They're all toxins, and therefore, evidence-based medicine, well, it's an important thing. It doesn't work very well, but it'd be good if it did, wouldn't it?
Yeah,
it really would be good if it did. But with approaches which are largely completely non-toxic, in fact, they're all plus, they're health-promoting things. They're not about killing anything or destroying anything. They're about promoting your own health. The same concerns really don't even feature, do they?
No, and I think another element is that one of the things with the drug approach is that the more drugs you pile into somebody, the more likely they are to suffer from toxic side effects. They're just beginning to use two drugs, or they use a sequence of ones, and each of them knock back your immune system or cause actual destruction to gut or to hair or other things, the familiar side effects. Whereas with the CAM interventions, you don't have a problem if you combine diet with some supplements, with some massage, with some hyperbaric oxygen. They build on top of each other,
right,
rather than making the patient weaker.
Right. Okay, well, the commission are busy chewing it over at the moment. All the submissions are in from all the interested bodies as to why we should either clamp down with EBM or not. We just have to hope that some common sense prevails now. We've got our fingers crossed that they're going to see sense. They don't have to change their rules at all, I believe. It's the only thing they've been pushed to do by this group are to actually do a review and then to make a decision.
But if they do decide to do a lot of changing or to argue for much more rigorous forms of evaluation that's really appropriate for pharmaceuticals, it's the kind of thing that one might start to see a reaction from the patient group. Already patients have been voting with their wallets or feet or whatever
in
terms of it, and I think to have that arbitrarily taken away, on rather ironically on the grounds of safety, is. And just one other point, which it struck me with the Cancer Drug Fund evaluation, was that one of the major arguments with the attempt to get a parliamentary bill through last year, I think it was, which would allow doctors to supply non-authorised, non-conventional treatments to certain groups of patients who were quite far down the line, was rejected. And one of the main arguments for rejecting it was because to allow these other treatments into the mainstream would be promoting what was described as false hope. Well, it seems to me that an absolutely major example of promoting false hope is the Cancer Drug Fund,
absolutely,
where they spent £1 billion offering drugs to people which did no good for them at all.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, peddling false hope, that's it. Okay, well look, now I'd like to turn to the thorny subject of sugar and cancer, with one of our top cancer hospitals advising that sugar, honey, syrup, treacle and sugary foods such as chocolate, cakes and sweets are good sources of energy, and our leading cancer research charity, including Sugar Feeding Cancer in its top 10 cancer myths, and dietitians viciously attacking a proponent of the ketogenic diet that aims to starve cancers of glucose, we've got a situation on our hands, basically. All of the above claim to practice EBM. What do you think?
Well, I think that perhaps it would be useful for listeners to just to very quickly sketch in why sugar should be a problem,
right,
and what the basic idea behind the diet is. So essentially, well, we know that cancers are hungry for glucose because that's the way that we identify them in the body, that the scans that are done on the body measure the uptake of glucose in particular cells, and you look at them, you can see the illuminated area in the scans, and you say that's where your cancer is, because it's really sucking in an awful lot more glucose than normal. So the idea that cancer cells feed on glucose is really not something that's up for discussion. The issue which is up for discussion is there anything you can do about it? Is it worth doing anything to reduce the amount of glucose that's shooting around your body? And of course, the way to increase the amount of glucose in your body is to eat high levels of carbohydrates, and that list that you read out that the leading cancer hospital was saying that people should eat has large amounts of carbohydrates, refined carbohydrates, which put sugar in faster and more effectively. And so there is a real sense within the medical profession that it's absolutely fine to whack up the level of blood glucose. And so I've always been slightly surprised at how opposed to the idea of cutting back on sugar, because what the low-carb diet says is that you can bring down the level of carbohydrates pretty low, maybe 10 grams a day. And if you go down to that sort of level, you then move into a different metabolic state in the body. And we probably haven't got time to go into it in a lot of detail, but essentially the body is like a hybrid car. It can run off two forms of fuel. There's a fuel that we all know about, which is glucose, because you do need glucose for energy, and everybody knows that marathon runners and so on have to keep taking in glucose in order to keep them going. But there is another source of energy, which are things called ketones, and when the body naturally produces these ketones when the level of glucose from carbohydrates has dropped right down. If we didn't have this system, anytime we didn't get enough, fill ourselves up with enough carbohydrates, we'd keel over and die. So it's obviously a survival mode. So the question is, does bringing down carbs to a really low level, cut off supplies of sugar to cancers, and B, whether the ketones is an acceptable alternative? And there's good reason for saying that both of those happen, because the cancers, one of the things about cancer, and this has been known for about 100 years, is that the normal way that cells make energy is through small power packs in every cell called mitochondria, and they pump through glucose and produce energy at the other end, ATP, a molecule which powers all of us. In cancers, the mitochondrial production of energy is not working very well. So cancers use another method, which is much more intensive, glucose intensive, and that's why they show up on these scans and so on. And they also change things in the way that they organise themselves so they can suck more glucose out of the blood and feed themselves. So seems to me, and it did, it's always, ever since I came across it, really makes sense to cut down on the sugar. But there's dietary advice from dietitians who say, no, this is really not what you want to do, because the thing they focus on is that glucose is a source of energy and the body needs energy and so on. And so we can't, trying to say, well, you should cut out a one particular sort of energy source isn't a good idea, is dangerous. Glucose, they say in one of the papers that are up on Cancer Research UK's website, is that say glucose is a basic fuel which they say correctly powers all of our cells, but the point is, does it have to power? Is there another source of energy? And it's very clear from what the Cancer Research UK says on their website, which is there is no evidence that following a sugar-free diet lowers the risk of getting cancer or boosts the chance of surviving. Now, that assumes, A, that it's only sugar which is the problem. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's not the case. It's carbohydrates, right. Because all carbohydrates get turned into glucose, which is what right. We're talking about. So that's a very misleading statement, mm-hmm. focusing just on sugar. And they talk about the fact that having a restricted diet with very low amounts of carbohydrate could damage health. This is one of the standard lines used against almost every single complementary treatment, is it could damage health. We don't actually know that it does, but it could. And this is then put forward as evidence as to why you shouldn't do it.
Right.
In fact, a severely a diet with very low levels of carbohydrate has been used for centuries to treat diabetes. This isn't the way that it's done now, but it has been done in the past. And it's currently used by paediatricians to treat childhood epilepsy.
Right.
So there is, we know that people put on these diets for a long period of time do not have long-term damage.
Right. So it's actually safe.
So it's safe, providing you have it done by a proper dietitian who can look and monitor various nutrients and the rest of it, which you do use, it's harder. But the actual idea of cutting down on carbohydrates is not going to do massive damage, and particularly in the context of cancer. You know, it's accepted that cancer is a hideous disease, and therefore it's reasonable to use possibly toxic treatments in order to treat
right.
it.
And just to put in there a sort of common sense angle, is of course, if you look back culturally at some parts of the planet, they would have eaten a very low carbohydrate diet because
exactly.
they ate fat all the time in some places, didn't they?
Exactly.
And so,
yes. Well,
it must work.
So, and if we couldn't survive without having carbohydrates, you know, the Eskimos wouldn't do
exactly.
very well.
They'd have had it.
And that's alarming, I think, because it shows that the level of understanding of what goes on with diet and cancer is very, very primitive and lacks any kind of sophistication at all. And yet these are the people who are supposed to be setting guidelines for what people with cancer should
right.
eat. So
yeah.
I find that alarming.
Right.
So there's then another way of looking at it, which is that this issue of cutting out sugar, as they call it, but cutting out carbohydrates is a good idea, was heavily attacked about 3 or 4 months ago by somebody called Dr. Grimes, who's actually a physicist at Oxford. He wrote a piece for The Guardian in which he said that the low-carbohydrate ketogenic diet, which is the one that we've just been talking about, that where you start producing these things called ketones from fat, which the body can use for energy instead of glucose, is a pernicious myth, was how it was described.
Right.
And when I saw this, I was amazed. I wasn't amazed. I was irritated because I've seen the this pernicious myth that it doesn't make a difference promoted heavily. And there is a brilliant book which anyone who's interested in diet and cancer really ought to look at, called Tripping Over the Truth, by an American science writer called Travis Christofferson.
Right.
And I asked him to write some stuff for the website I have, cancer, healthinsightuk.org. And what Travis pointed out was that Grimes made at least three major errors in his assumption. And again, you've got this picture that just as dieticians don't really understand what the role of diet in cancer, so a physicist doesn't understand what's going on with the metabolism of the body and the physiological pathways when you go into this different form of using a ketogenic diet, which isn't using carbohydrates, isn't using glucose to the same extent, but is using these fat energy packages. So you've got the first thing that he said was that cancer is driven by genetic changes, and it all gets a little bit complicated, but essentially there's growing evidence that there are serious problems with the genetic idea. And so the idea that the only way that you can generate cancer is by gene changes is not nearly as clear as we have thought in the past. And it does seem as though the ketogenic diet, and there's some recent research which Travis has been talking about, is able to benefit healthy cells and make a problem for cancer cells. And the reason it makes a problem is that in healthy cells, the glucose can be used in their little power packs, the mitochondria, whereas in cancer cells, there's a problem with their mitochondria. So they can't actually generate energy with the ketogenic diet, which is the patient is being fed. So rather than messing people up with a treatment, you have a treatment which actually can be used very successfully by the body, but not by cancer. So when you combine that, the ketogenic element, plus the lower glucose, you've really got a very sensible package for treating cancer. It makes a lot of sense. Mm. It hasn't been tested in great detail. There's about 14 clinical trials going on. There are at least two going on in the UK. They're trying to get funding for it, but it's the same old story. There really isn't any money in it,
right.
And who should step up and fund it?
Yeah.
But it is happening. There's some brilliant American researchers who've been looking at it with animal models, and all the physiology has been really extensively worked out. And the idea that these people are pontificating about this sort of diet doesn't work, there's no evidence for it, and could be dangerous, which is always the rider that's put on, is just shocking. It's a really interesting new development, which in any sane system would say, look, we're not getting good results, guys, we're paying an absolute fortune. Here's something that's come along that's really cheap, and it could make patients far less damaged and healthier. Let's give it a try. Let's put some of that £1 billion that went into completely useless drugs and spend it on investigating the potential of ketogenic. Mm. So the idea that we have an evidence-based system which is designed to produce the best results for patients, it really doesn't seem to be working in the way that we're being told that it is.
Mm. So, yeah, it's got a fundamental problem just at the entry point, because there's any particular kinds of things that even get into the system to get tested.
Yes.
Apart from the problems further down the
line. Well, we've outsourced our provision of treatments for all disorders, but cancer in particular, to corporations who, quite rightly, are aimed at making money. That's all they want to do.
Yeah.
And so if you go along to them and say, hey, we've got this great new treatment, which I think we could really help people, and they say, well, you know, is it going to make £1 billion a year? And you say, well, no, you just have to eat rather fewer carbohydrates.
Right.
So, but you then have to say, well, is that a sane way of trying to get something treated? And in my book, it certainly isn't.
Right. Okay. Well, look, we're coming towards the end. I just thought we'd do a round off with a general look at EBM. We've already said a lot about it. First of all, well, how it's working in the field, which it's really targeting, which is the drugs and major sort of conventional interventions, and then how it looks with regard to everything else, and maybe what we should be looking at in terms of dealing with this huge disparity and allowing some flexibility into our medical system.
Well, you can see the problem with the evidence-based randomized controlled trial system very clearly in the case of statins, for example, which are drugs which are the most widely used drugs. They have generated multi-billion pound revenues for the drug firms, and they're essentially focused just on reducing cholesterol. I won't get into a debate about whether reducing cholesterol is a good idea for heart disease or not, but the point about them is that they are a classic example of a drug which an awful lot of people have to take in order to benefit. It looks as though there's good evidence if you've had a heart attack. If you hadn't had a heart attack, there might be one person in 100 or one in 200. The figures vary a bit, they get rather waffly. So huge numbers of people have to take them for no benefit at all, but it's evidence-based medicine because there is a proportion of people who benefit.
So importantly, those people who are not getting the benefit, they're actually getting the harm that goes with them.
So the risk of harm would stay the same. It's been well known for years and years and years that there is a problem with muscle pain. More recently, there's evidence has come up that they do increase your risk of diabetes, again, to what extent is queried. And there is still even 25 or more years, I think it is, that statins have been around. There still isn't really a definitive position on side effects. There are, though, clinicians will say, we see quite a lot of people with problems. Those who run clinical trials say, oh, they're very, very low, very small. And there's long-running battles and debates around all of this. One other thing I might just mention is that the evidence which the companies have gathered for saying that these drugs are safe and effective has never ever been examined by anybody else. They are the private property of the companies, and there is a unit in Oxford which has held all of the results of the trials for since about the middle of the 1980s, and their deal is that they can do analyses of it, but nobody can see the raw data. And we've known for years that the drug companies are quite likely to play fast and loose with that data. So you've got something where no one's seen the actual raw data. The way that the side effect data is collected is questionable, and it would really need to be looked at independently. And yet these drugs are supposedly the finest flowering of the evidence-based system.
The gold standard.
There's at least 30 large randomized controlled trials of statins, the gold standard. We still aren't clear about the rate of side effects, and there are reasons to be suspicious about how many people are benefiting and whether they aren't massively overprescribed. So, serious problem with the randomized controlled trial evidence-based medicine model for drugs in that way. And the other area is in diet, with the high-fat, low-fat diet, because, of course, the big battle which is going on within the cancer community over the low-carb diet is repeated on a much bigger scale with whether we should all be eating a low-fat diet and having our skim milk and our skinless chicken and all the rest of it, which we've all been told to do for years. And there is now a number of serious researchers who have looked at the data for the low-fat diet and really found it heavily wanting. And there's, again, evidence that the established bodies who are still supporting the low-fat diet have been just simply ignoring evidence of the benefits of the low-carb diet. And it's very interesting that in South Africa at the moment, there has been going on for 3 years a trial involving a senior nutrition professor, Professor Tim Noakes, who was, as all nutritionists were, you know, 10, 15 years ago, totally in favour of the low-fat diet. He was an expert in sports medicine. He would run marathons and all the rest of it. And he had textbooks in which he would describe the low-fat diet and how you had to feed carbohydrate load in order to do it and so on. And he then started investigating the evidence, and he decided actually the low-carb model makes more sense, generating the ketones, which the body can use just as well, and you don't run into a wall and so on. And he has been campaigning on that for some time. And the dietitian's establishment, rather than saying, this is really interesting, here's a really top guy, one of the major scientists, hundreds of peer-reviewed papers to his name, really top guy, has decided to change. And rather than saying, tell us what's going on, let's look at it, let's make a change, he has spent 3 years going through an endlessly protracted hearing in which he's put out lots of evidence and other supporters have come in and so on. And what it really looks like is that there isn't a proper forum for changing the kind of official evidence that we have.
Right.
Where the system is kind of bust in terms of making a change.
Yeah, they're always trying to get to the facts and then stick to them.
Yeah.
That is the kind of model, isn't it?
Yes.
And then we stick to them for as long as we possibly can.
They hang in there.
Yeah, it's terrible. So clearly it's not working very well in the orthodox area. We've already talked about the fact that it's really not even applicable in CAM. The thing that could potentially straddle the problems in both areas, though, is what's called real-world data, which, for some reason, our NHS, which is, of course, the biggest, most enormous source of real-world data, really, really hasn't taken the challenge and picked it up. But they could be telling us whether statins actually work or not quite easy. We don't need the statin makers to do it. The NHS could tell us. And similarly, they could tell us whether the ketogenic diet works as well. They could use the same systems for collecting the same data on any kind of intervention, CAM or conventional.
Well, in terms of getting a CAM and or other interventions, you know, being used in a responsible way, what's going on with diabetes is very interesting, because you've got two things that have happened there. One is that there's been a kind of grassroots revolution by the doctors, and about 3 years ago, a pioneering GP, a guy called David Unwin, found out about the low-carb diet, because all the arguments that we've been discussing to do with low carbs and cancer apply just as strongly for diabetes, because diabetes is a disorder where you have a problem handling glucose. And again, madness, we have a current set of advice that says to diabetics, well, you have a problem handling glucose, therefore we recommend you to eat a high carbohydrate diet, which will, after every meal, push your levels of blood glucose up, which is, you know, to an outsider, madness.
Yeah.
And Dr. Unwin said, well, yeah, the physiology makes sense. And he came across a website called diabetes.co.uk, which had been set up for patients. And it had about, 3 years ago, it's more now, but 3 years ago, it had something like 200,000 or 300,000 diabetics who had sort of off their own bat, completely outside the establishment approach to diabetes, which again, like cancer, is a massive drug industry, controlled. And they'd started following the low-carb diet, because the physiology, the simple explanation about not feeding a glucose problem with glucose, makes instant, everyone can understand it. And so they started following the diet, and then they did something else really important, which was they started uploading the data
doing their
onto
own
trials. The web to doing their own trials. Yeah. So it's one thing to say, well, oh, it's just an anecdote. But when you've got 10,000 people all reporting,
I
lost this much weight, and and key, I lost this much weight, my markers for diabetes came down, and I either stopped using drugs completely or cut down the amount of drugs that I needed. Mm. And it's that kind of real-world data that you can then you can now quantify with computers and the internet and all the rest of it and so on. And I think it would be really exciting if people in the cancer world started reporting their results in that kind of way. They could upload markers. It's not hard statistically clean data. It's a bit messy.
Not, but it's the volume of it.
It's the sheer volume of it. Mm. And at the end, when it comes in with that, to say, oh, well, it's not really clean, we'll ignore it. You have to then say, well, we must do
the proper
a proper trial. And if it has to be done by a government funding and not on a commercial basis, then...
The Cancer Trial Fund.
Yeah.
Right.
It would be a much better use of the money.
It would be a great use of the money. Okay, well, look, we're out of time. That was really interesting. Thank you very much for all your insights on this whole arena. I mean, it's a thorny area, and there's some major conflicts happening at the moment. But in some ways, it's good, because new forces are at work which are pushing things forward which simply weren't there before, and that's exciting.
Can I just say one thing which seems to sum it up for me, which is that we have had a number of big political upheavals, which we all know about, in which people are saying there's a democratic deficit, that there's the country's, the economy has been run to favour hugely a relatively small proportion of the country, and a lot of people are missing out because they just aren't part of this huge generation of wealth. And I would argue that we have something similar going on with our medical system. We have a medical system which clearly benefits pharmaceutical companies heavily. I'm not opposed to pharmaceutical companies. We need drugs, they can be useful. But it shouldn't only be designed for the benefit of pharmaceutical companies. And we need a bit more people who are in the medical constituencies of various sorts saying, well, we want someone who's going to be thinking about us and how we can benefit. And the very obvious way that people can benefit is by using some of these lifestyle approaches and gaining knowledge and treating themselves and recording the results. And great to see how that went.
Power to the people. Great. Thank you very much, Jerome.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, there really is a lot going on out there, some of which has the potential to affect our healthcare freedom in very fundamental ways. A reminder to you that Yes to Life has a book on integrative medicine available. It's called The Cancer Revolution, and you can find out more or order at thecancerrevolution.co.uk. Also, Yes to Life has upcoming events you may want to attend. A visit to the linseed farm near Horsham to find out about the health benefits of linseed with Derwin Banks. That's on the 10th of June. And on the 22nd, there is Uncovering a New Perspective in Integrative Oncology, Medicinal Mushrooms. That's an evening event in Camden, London. Full details and booking on the Yes to Life website under events. Lastly, also on the Yes to Life website, you'll find links to materials mentioned in this show on the UK Health Radio page listed under Media Centre. Do join me again next week for more insights into the world of integrative medicine for cancer. Goodbye.